I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Ina Garten, founder of the culinary empire known as Barefoot Contessa. Ina is a chef, a cookbook writer, and one of the cooking stars on the Food Network. Ina officially started her culinary career when she bought a 400-square-foot store in the Hamptons on Long Island called the Barefoot Contessa. Her first cookbook sold over 2 million copies, and her Food Network show has attracted almost 6 million viewers per week. Ina is popular for her emphasis on no-fuss entertaining. Welcome, Ina.
It's so nice to be here, Jessica. Thanks.
I heard a story that you weren't allowed in the kitchen, yet you spend all of your waking hours in that room. What was the story behind that?
Well, I'd like to think that I'm acting out. Even at this age, I'm still acting out. My mother used to say to me, it's my job to cook, it's your job to study, get out of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, I spent the rest of my life trying to get into the kitchen.
And why was she so adamant about your staying out of the kitchen?
She wanted me to study hard. She was very intellectual. So to her, intellectual pursuits and culture and studying was really important. And I'm much more hands-on. I just like to roll up my sleeves and do something. And I was interested in science, and which I think really relates to cooking.
Mm. And what did your dad do?
My father was a physician. He loved to have a good time. He loved style, all those things. I think I'm very closely related to him.
Did your parents entertain a lot when you were growing up?
My parents did. My father had lots and lots of friends. I think entertaining was a little painful for my mother because she would get very nervous about it. But my father just loved having friends over.
What did you aspire to be professionally when you were growing up?
You know, I grew up in a different time than you are. I'm 59. I grew up really at the cutting edge of the women's movement. Gloria Steinem was just coming to force. And actually, I always say that my husband was the first feminist I ever met. When we were first married, I was still in college. And I remember him coming home one day, and it was 11 o'clock in the morning, and I was watching That Girl on TV. And he looked at me and said, you need to figure out what you're going to do with your life. And it had never occurred to me. Hmm. I thought, I'm married. That's what I do with my life.
Wow.
And so he really encouraged me to do something. And that was really the beginning of my career.
Go husband.
Yeah.
Really,
he's
really
the best.
Nice. So even though you weren't allowed in the kitchen, you still had food interwoven in your life. When you were courting your then boyfriend, now husband,
yeah.
What are examples of your cooking or baking?
Well, I remember when I was in high school, I have no idea what behooved me to do this, but I decided to send him brownies in a shoebox. Isn't that what we all did? And I think that pretty much won him over.
So you were in high school while he was at Dartmouth College?
Yes, he saw me when I was 15, and so I met him right soon after that when I was 16. So I was in high school, he was in college.
So after the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. you and Jeff decided to take a trip to Europe, and I'm wondering what impact that experience had on your interest in culinary endeavors.
Well, you know, it was a time, we had 4 months between when he finished the Army and he went to graduate school in Washington, and we didn't have any money. I mean, we just didn't have anything. So we decided we'd take a 4-month camping trip through Europe. And I remember we had $5 a day, literally. If we spent $10 one day, we had to go home a day early. So we bought ourselves a tent and some sleeping bags. And that was when you go to Europe on $99. So we rented a car, a little Renault Quatre, and we tootled around. But literally, including the campsite fee, we had $5. So I would go to the market and buy vegetables and couscous and things like that. And we had a little camping gas stove, and I would cook dinner every night.
Mm.
I just remember it being so totally blown away by the markets in France. And it was just such a pleasure to go and get a baguette and a pear and a piece of brie, and that was lunch.
Mm.
And so I think that was really the beginning of my awakening of great ingredients and how you really don't have to do a lot.
And it shows really your ingenuity or your resourcefulness, the fact that you were able to create these delicious concoctions using a tent stove.
Yeah. It's funny. I the thing that my husband remembers the most about that 4-month camping trip was not just the food, but I used to go to the market and buy like a piece of fabric and make a tablecloth out of it. You know, I liked it to be a whole thing, which is really, I think, what my interest in entertaining is.
So when you get back to the United States, what did you do? Where did you live?
Well, we moved to Washington. Jeffrey was at graduate school at Johns Hopkins. And I got a job, I think, at NASDAQ. I don't know what I was doing there, but it was supposed to be a serious job. And and because I really hated my job, I used to entertain all the time. And I went out and bought Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And I worked my way through both of those volumes. And I really taught myself how to cook. And I used to entertain every single weekend. I'd have a dinner party. And I think the dinner party was the anticlimax of the experience. I just loved coming home at night and cooking.
You talk about the dinner party being the anticlimax. Did you feel stressed during those parties?
Oh, it was just really easy. No, it's hard. Of course I did. I'd lie on the sofa on Sunday and go, I'm never doing that again. And then on Monday I'd start cooking again.
Oh.
It's one of the things that is the basis of what I do. Entertaining is really hard. And it's not just getting a dinner out with all the courses at the same time, but it's also creating an atmosphere where people are relaxed and having fun, and they feel like what you've just done, this dinner, is something you just whipped up in the 10 minutes before they got there. Because that's when the host and hostess are having fun, that's the most fun. So I really sort of cut my teeth on those dinner parties in Washington.
Now, while you were in Washington, you also worked for the White House. What did you end up doing there?
After NASDAQ, I actually got a job in the White House, a group called Office of Management and Budget. And as I said, I was interested in science. So I worked in the science area. I worked in nuclear energy policy. I mean, again, what was I doing there?
What were you doing there?
I think I was just trying to prove that I was smart. But at some point, I decided I don't want to grow up to be Jeffrey, as wonderful as he is. I needed to do something else.
Now, you mentioned that you might have wanted to prove that you were smart. Were you trying to maybe prove to yourself or to Jeffrey that you weren't just another kind of housewife with vocational interest?
Gelsie, he wrote a book called Passages, and one of which actually came out when I was just 30 and I was trying to decide what to do. And one of the things that she said is very often women in their 20s try to grow up to be their husbands or their fathers or try to sort of prove themselves. And then exactly at 30, they say, that's not who I am. And they go off and do something that's them. And I think I read this book like a month after I bought Barefoot Contessa. And I thought, that's exactly what I did.
And that's exactly what I did, by the way.
Did
you?
Very
resonant.
Isn't that wonderful? So you need to do that. You need to know what it is and know what it's not. And then to have the confidence to go off and do something on your own. Good for you. Great.
Good for you. But before you went off to buy and to operate Barefoot Contessa, you did still spend some time in the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget. Mm-hmm. How long were you there?
I was there for 4 years, from 1974 to 1978. I mean, in the beginning, you just say, this is very cool. The issue papers I'm writing are going to the president. I mean, that's pretty sexy. And it was really interesting. But after 4 years, I realized I was working on issues that were $20 billion, which at that time was, I mean, still money, but it was huge. And then 4 years later, I realized I'm still working on the same $20 billion project. I can't get it done, and neither can the president. It's too difficult to get anything done in Washington, and that was in the 70s. Can you imagine now? So I decided I'd rather work on $20 projects, but they were my own $20.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the Barefoot Contessa, Ina Garten. Ina has built a culinary empire, starting with her specialty food store in the Hamptons on Long Island, and continuing with her cookbooks and her show on the Food Network. Ina also has a line of prepared ingredients called Barefoot Contessa Pantry in partnership with Stonewall Kitchen, which is based in Maine. Her first 5 books sold over 5 million copies, and her show on the Food Network has attracted almost 6 million viewers per week. Okay, so you're done with the White House, and you say, I want to move on and get involved in the culinary world and start my own business. What was that process like?
Well, everybody says it was very brave, but it really wasn't. I got to the point in my job where I thought, I can't do this one more minute. And I have a very low threshold of boredom with it, which I think helps push me out the door when it's time to move. And I was in my office at the White House, and I was in OMB, and I was reading the New York Times at like 10 o'clock in the morning. I was exhausted, and I thought, if I'm tired at 10 in the morning, it's not a good sign. And I saw an ad for business for sale that in the, you know, the business opportunity section in the New York Times that you never read. It was the first time I'd ever read it. And there was a specialty food store in a place I'd never been before. It was the Hamptons. And I thought, oh, that's so interesting. I was interested in food. I was interested in business. And I wanted to do something on my own. So I went home that night and I said to Jeffrey, I really need to do something different. I really need to just get out of this White House thing and do something on my own. And he said something that was so important. He said, why don't you just pick something you've always wanted to do? Just do it. Don't worry about making money. Just do it. Mm-hmm. And I said, funny you should mention it. I saw this ad for a business for sale. And he said, let's go look at it tomorrow. Isn't that wonderful?
What a husband.
Oh, he's just wonderful. So we jumped in the car the next day. We drove up to a town I'd never been to before, West Hampton. It was March. Anybody that's been to West Hampton in March knows there's like tumbleweed going down the middle of the street. Mm-hmm. And there was this tiny store that just glowed. And I thought, this is exactly what I want to do. So I made the owner a low offer. I thought, well, she'll come back. We'll negotiate. And Jeffrey and I drove back to Washington.
By the way, Washington and West Hampton are, what, 6 hours from each other?
Yeah, at least. Six, maybe eight, yeah.
Why didn't you think of maybe doing this closer to home?
Well, this was the one for sale. I just thought I'd take a chance.
How did you finance the purchase of this new store?
Well, one of the things I used to do when I was in Washington is I used to buy old houses, renovate them, and sell them. It was just to entertain myself, really. But fortunately, I made a little bit of money, so I used that money to buy the store.
What a pioneer. You real estate mogul.
Oh, no. Very tiny.
And you were 30 at the time?
I was exactly 30. It was a month after my 30th birthday. So Gail Sheehy was right.
And Barefoot Contessa, where does the name come from?
Well, it was actually the name of a movie originally from the 50s with Humphrey Bogart and Ava Gardner. And the woman I bought it from, Diana Strada, who's just deeply wonderful, when she was a little girl, she's Italian. So when she was the little girl, they used to call her the Barefoot Contessa. So she actually stayed on with me. One of the things I did was I made a deal with her that she would stay on with me for a month to teach me what I needed to know, because I didn't know how to slice smoked salmon. I didn't know where you buy brie. I didn't know how to tell whether it was ripe. What I knew was like Bonbel from the grocery store. You know, it was the 70s. People didn't make their own bread and they didn't have really good imported cheese. And she was a fabulous teacher.
At the time, was there any self-doubt that this wouldn't work out, or were you kind of confident that this would be
crazy?
Successful?
After the first weekend, I said to Jeffrey, this was the stupidest thing I've ever done in my entire life. Mm. I think as I look back over several stages, what I've done is what I now can recognize is I jump off a cliff and I figure out how to fly on the way down. And it really focuses my attention. I try something I don't think there's any way in hell I can do. And it really forces me to work really hard. But it was something I loved doing. So when I went home at night after an exhausting day at the store, I'd think, well, what do I feel like doing? And what I felt like doing is testing that chocolate cake I had on my mind. So I'd be back at the store. Didn't feel like work. It felt like playing.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ina Garten, the founder of the culinary empire known as Barefoot Contessa. We'll hear more from Ina coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Ina Garten, founder of the culinary empire known as Barefoot Contessa. Ina is a chef, a cookbook writer, and one of the cooking stars on the Food Network. Ina officially started her culinary career when she bought a 400-square-foot store in the Hamptons on Long Island called the Barefoot Contessa. Her first cookbook sold over 2 million copies, and her Food Network show has attracted almost 6 million viewers per week. Ina is popular for her emphasis on no-fuss entertaining. Were you always impulsive in your life growing up? Because this was a very impulsive decision to some degree. You were committed to your craft, but it was also 5 hours away from, or more so, from D.C., and you had never done it before.
I think I wasn't impulsive, but I was never allowed to be. Mm. And I think Jeffrey encourages me. He really takes the handcuffs off. And he says to me, looks straight at me and says, you can do this. And it's very empowering for somebody to do that with you.
What impact did your moving to the Hamptons have on your marriage? Did Jeff move with you, or was he in D.C. during the week?
He was in D.C. during the week. He was still working for the Secretary of State. We just decided that he would come up on the weekends. The store was only open in the summer. So for 6 months a year, I worked really hard. And then by the next winter, he'd move to New York and become an investment banker. Mm. So we basically spent the winters together and then the summer, the weekends. It's not easy, but I mean, we decided we were going to make it work. And if it didn't work, then we would change it.
Now, at 30, many women are about to start a family. And instead, you bought this store. Did you ever think about having children, or what was your psychology with that at the time?
It actually was a decision of mine very early on. I didn't want to have children. So it made the decision so much easier. I don't have to choose between work and children. I think there's no way I could have done what I've done if I had children. So that was part of the decision.
Well, that's very realistic, but knowing what I know of you, you probably could have fit it in.
I don't know. That's very nice, but I'm not so sure.
So talk to me about the early days when you were just starting to operate Barefoot Contessa. Did they come immediately, the customers, or what was that dynamic like?
Well, one of the things that was wonderful, in retrospect, I'd like to say I did this deliberately, but in retrospect, is that it was a train that had already left the station. I really don't believe I could have started this from scratch. I didn't know enough. I didn't understand where to buy food. I didn't know how to sell it. I really didn't know anything about it. I just knew how to make brownies for my friends. But making 200 brownies for a store is a whole different science. I started with something that was real, and I decided I would just do that for one summer, exactly the way it was done without changing anything, just to learn how to do it. And yes, there was a line out the door from the first day. I'll tell you a story about the first day was Thursday before Memorial Day weekend. I remember at the end of the day, Jeffrey took off from his job with the Secretary of State to help me get set up. I don't know why, but it was very sweet of him. And at the end of the first day, there was like $85 in the register. And I remember him with a calculator going, "You're never going to make it here." We had no idea that Friday of Memorial Day weekend in the Hamptons was going to be a whole different thing. At the end of the day, Friday, we closed the door at 10 o'clock at night, and there was nothing left in the store, absolutely nothing. And so Diane Estrada and I stayed up all night baking and cooking. We went to the grocery store for flour and sugar. And by the next day, we opened the doors, and there we were.
Now, you seem like a very outgoing individual. In fact, a good friend of yours, I think it was Steven Drucker, said that Ina glows in the dark. And it seems, though, that cooking can be a very solitary act. You know, you're face-to-face with the ingredients all day. Was that ever an issue for you?
I'm actually not a chef. I think of myself as a cook who's had a little more experience than most people. And I always had a chef who worked in the kitchen. So I mean, Jeffrey used to describe it as a sandbox. There was always something interesting to do in the store. I loved doing the displays. I loved working with customers. I loved working with people who worked with me. And when I had time, I would go in the kitchen and figure out a better chocolate cake. But I was never really stuck doing one thing. And for the way I am, which is slightly ADD, I think, there was always something fun to do in that store.
You say that you're not a chef with some adamancy. Then what are you if not a chef?
I mean, maybe this is a little strong, but I actually think of myself as a business person who cooks. I think that one of the things that served me very well is that I don't know how to make sponge sugar. I don't know how to do what chefs on a line know how to do, which is touch the steak and say it's medium rare. And that's actually why I think my cooking relates to people at home, because I'm still the person standing at the oven door going, "I don't know, is the chicken done?" I mean, it's hard. It's really hard cooking. And if you've done it on a line, it gets easier and easier, and it's never gotten easier for me.
Now, I want to go back to still the Barefoot Contessa days when you did run the store for about 20 years.
Yes.
What was harder for you than you thought? It seemed like you had quite good luck in those early years. You had the customers. You were in a good financial situation. What was more challenging than you expected?
It's really hard work. I loved it because it was really fun, but the hours are hard. I think probably the hardest thing that I didn't count on, you know, when you choose a profession, a lifestyle comes along with it. Mm-hmm. And very, very often you don't think about the lifestyle. I think the hardest thing was working on weekends. When Jeffrey would come out for the weekend, I was working Saturdays, and then I would go out and cater 10 parties on Saturday night and come home and want to lie on the sofa on Sunday. So I think that was the hardest thing that I didn't count on.
After 20 years, you decided to close close shop or to sell the store. What was motivating that decision?
I really felt like I'd done what I needed to in the specialty food business, and I wasn't bringing the kind of energy to it and the creativity that I thought I should. I sort of hit a wall, and I thought, okay, I can either sell it to somebody else or I can sell it to the two people who actually work in the store, the manager and the chef, and they were interested in buying it. So we worked out a deal and I sold it to them over time.
How long was that process of deciding that you were going to sell the store?
About 60 seconds. Once I decided to do it, it was time to move on. One of the things that happened to me is a friend of mine who's a therapist said to me, type A people think that they can figure out what to do next while they're doing something. It doesn't work. And finally, in sheer frustration about what I was going to do next, I decided, okay, I'm going to trust her. I'm just going to sell the store. I'm going to build myself an office upstairs, and I'm going to go there at 9 o'clock every morning and say, okay, what am I going to do today? And it was a really hard 8-10 months where I had nothing. I went from being incredibly busy to have nothing to do.
How depressing.
It was really depressing. But I just persevered. I studied the stock market thinking maybe that's what I was going to do. A friend of mine laughs about I was going to start a bus company. I mean, I had all kinds of wacky ideas. And finally, Jeffrey said to me, He's definitely a theme in this. He's my best advisor. He said, you love the food business, stay in the game. And so I thought, well, people have asked me to write cookbooks, so I'm not really interested in writing a cookbook, but it'll be something to do tomorrow. Mm. So I made a proposal and sent it to a publisher, and oh my God, they accepted it.
So it was almost a form of therapy to write a cookbook in a way.
It was as simple as I needed something to do. And I thought, well, I'll write a cookbook while I'm figuring out what to do.
I want to go back to some of the things that you were flirting with before you decided, okay, I'm going to write the cookbook. And you mentioned that you were studying the stock market. What did you read?
Everything Warren Buffett had ever written or been said about Warren Buffett. He's just amazing. And I admire his talent, but you have to be as smart as Warren Buffett to do that.
Do you do your own investing?
I did then. Not really.
Okay, so you decide to write this cookbook, even if you weren't going to finish it.
I had this contract with Clarkson Potter to write a cookbook, and I said to my new editor, Roy Finnemore, I said, well, first thing we need to do is hire somebody to write the book, because I don't know how to write. I know how to write nuclear energy issue papers, but that's it. And he said, no, you're going to write the book. So I took all the money they gave me, put it in a separate account, because I thought, I'll be sending this back to them sometime, because there's no way I'm going to do this. And just out of sheer desperation of something to do, I started writing down the recipes that we'd used in the store. And then came the first photo shoot. And I hired the best of everybody that I could find, and we all got together in my house, and we started doing photographs. And that was so exciting. I loved doing that. And all of a sudden, the whole process became really fun. I never would have known.
And how much of your own money did you invest in the process?
Well, actually, the truth is I invested about $200,000 in the first cookbook, which is insane for a cookbook when you think of all the books out there. But I decided I really wanted to do this. If I was going to do it, I was going to make a business out of it, and I want to knock the ball out of the park.
And do you remember that first moment when you saw the cookbook in its completion?
I'll never forget it. I was driving into New York, and my editor called and said, where are you? I said, well, I'm just coming into New York. He said, stop by my office. And I said, I don't have time to stop by your office. I had a meeting. He said, well, just drive right up to the front of the office and I'll come out and give you something. I thought, oh, what is this? Mm-hmm. And there I was standing on the street when he handed me the first book. And I don't think anybody who writes cookbooks will ever forget their first cookbook.
How were sales initially?
Well, I was quite surprised, I have to say. The first time I was asked to give a talk, right after the book came out, it was before Mother's Day, and I was going out to California to somewhere in Orange County. Actually, Martha Stewart used to say, stop at bookstores and ask if you can sign them, and I thought, oh, just too shy to do that. I could never. But Jeffrey said, come on, let's stop at a bookstore, and we stopped at a Barnes & Noble in Newport, California, and I very shyly went up to the manager and said, would you like me to sign my books for you? And he said, well, what's the book? And I thought, oh, he'll never have heard of this. And I said, the Barefoot Contessa cookbook. And he said, oh, we have 50 of them on a table in the middle of the store. And I thought, oh my God, you do? And we walked over there and there wasn't a book on the table. And he said, oh, I was out yesterday. We must have sold them all yesterday. And I thought, oh, my God. It was the first inkling I had that there was something happening. And it was really quite thrilling. I wrote the book I wanted to read. And that's what I shot for. I wanted you to open the book and say, oh, my God, that photograph makes the food look so delicious. And then look at the recipe and say, that's really easy. I could do that. And there was something, I think, in that that appealed to people.
And I appreciate the little tips in the margins.
Oh, thank you.
For example, you said that squeezing a cold lemon produces less lemon juice than squeezing kind of a warm or room temperature
lemon. It does.
And I guess if you think of science, that makes sense because I guess the molecules are faster when it's warmer, or what's the reason behind
it? I can't even tell you what the science is. I know it works, but you learn that in a specialty food store when somebody says to you, could you squeeze a case of lemons for me?
Mm.
And you never want to do them cold.
Now, you had an interest in science growing up. Do you see cooking as a science at all?
I totally see it as science. When I decide I want to make a new recipe for scones, I see it as a science experiment. You know, I start with something. First, I do all the research that I can about what everybody says about scones. And then I put all the books away and I say, okay, what do I want this to taste like? I get a flavor and a texture in my head, and then I just start baking.
Mm.
And it might take me a day. It might take me a week. I might make 3 versions, I might make 25 versions, and I certainly have done that until I hit that ping in my head that says this is exactly what I'm looking for. And it's really, really, it's really like a science experiment to me, except instead of ending up with hydrochloric acid, I end up with scones.
Something edible.
Exactly.
Any other little tips just for me?
Oh. Well, one of the trademarks of the recipes is that I want you to feel confident when you go to the store. So, for example, in the Virginia ham glaze, it calls for 6.5 ounces of chutney. And when you go to the store, the jar is 6.5 ounces. So you say to yourself, oh, I've got the right jar. So everything I do is to make you feel confident.
And how about shocking the vegetables? I noticed I was doing a recipe, I think it was with sweet peas, and you said boil them for 3 minutes and then shock them in ice cold water. How come?
If you boil something until it's done and then you throw it in ice water, it stops the cooking and it sets the color.
Mm.
And then you can use it anytime you need it.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ina Garten, founder of the culinary empire Barefoot Contessa. Ina is the star of the Food Network show Barefoot Contessa, named after the store that she ran for 20 years in the Hamptons on Long Island. Ina's first cookbook, Barefoot Contessa, sold over 2 million copies. Another tip I appreciated was how you explained that kosher salt is sweeter than iodized salt?
It is. And it's very interesting. One of the things I do is I'll go to the store and get everything in a category, like all the salts. Mm. And the only way you can really tell what you like without any memory issues is to just line them all up and taste them all. So I took iodized salt, kosher salt, sea salt, flaked salt, fleur de sel, gray fleur de sel. I line them up on the counter and I just taste them all. And then you know forever which one you like. And when you do that, it's very clear that kosher salt is not as harsh as iodized salt, traditional table salt, what we call table salt.
Now, when you're in the kitchen with your experimenting, are you listening to music?
Yeah, I do.
What kind of music?
It gets me going, the energy. You know what I love is all of the Cost CDs. They're all mixed by a hotel in Paris called Cost, C-O-S-T-E-S.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
This is all done in your kitchen in East Hampton?
It is. As Jeffrey says, I commute to work in my slippers. It's not a bad life.
That's the best. And speaking of your kitchen in East Hampton, the Food Network show has been filmed in your kitchen in East Hampton.
It is indeed.
How did you end up on the Food Network?
Well, they very kindly came to me and asked if I would do a cooking show. And as with all of my other endeavors, I said, absolutely not. I couldn't imagine I could do this. So for actually a couple of years, they kept coming back every 6 months and saying, would you do it? And making me a better offer. And I kept saying no. I think they thought I was negotiating, but I really didn't think I could do it. One of the things I wanted is I wanted it to be a story. I didn't want it to be just cooking. I wanted to do the story of something. And the producer, Rachel Purnell at Pacific, was so smart because she said, well, it could be the story of a party.
Mm.
And so that's what we did. And we wanted it to be very real. I didn't want it to be sort of made up and prettified. So Rachel and I, before each show, sit down, and my other producer, Olivia Grove, we sit down and we say, okay, what did I do yesterday? What did I do last week? Did I have a party that was really fun? Did Jeffrey bring me something that was special? So that it's very real. And my favorite favorite question that people email me all the time and say, is that your television husband or your real husband? And I write them back, I'm not that good an actress. He's the real thing.
And he is on the show often.
He's wonderful. He's just great on the show.
It's striking to me how you've really launched a second career, even though it related to what you were doing for 20 years, at age 50 or at age 51. That's refreshing for people who think that they can have one career and then that's it.
It's actually one of my favorite things because it astonishes me that I did that. When I sold Barefoot Contessa, I thought, it's time to do something new, but I'll never find something as engaging and as compelling as running a specialty food store. And what's amazing to me is that at 50, I started a completely new career. I mean, it's in the food business, but it's completely different. It's so much more interesting, so much more engaging, and I just adore it.
How many episodes do you do a year, roughly?
Well, I do 20 episodes a year. You know, I try and incorporate East Hampton and the beach, and we go to the Honey Place. We go to the, you know, all, really to focus on the local produce and chickens from Iacona Farm. But we just do 20 shows a year.
And how long does it take to produce one show?
It takes 2 days, and we're talking long days from 8 in the morning till 7 at night to produce a 22-minute show.
Wow. Have you seen yourself improve from the earliest show to now?
You're assuming I see the shows. I can't stand to see the shows. I'm thrilled that people like them, but I think, why would they want to watch her? I'm much more comfortable. Confident, I wouldn't be so sure, but I'm certainly more comfortable.
I like one episode where at the end you made, I think it was green goddess dressing, which is sour cream and mayonnaise and fresh basil, and you dress the salad, you go upstairs, you sit in front of your computer, and you have dinner answering emails. And I loved it because it was so realistic. It's a lot of us sometimes, you know, eat by ourselves and we're working in front of the computer.
Thank you. It really reflects my life. I mean, there are days when I go out with friends, and there are days when my husband's there, and there are days when I answer emails all night.
Was there any part of you that was loath to kind of make your life open to 6 million viewers? Did you and Jeffrey have to sit down and say, okay, do we want this type of show where they're going to be seeing everything, or...
I think that that I wanted it so much to be a reality that I was really willing to, you know, to show the whole thing. Well, maybe not the whole thing.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jessica. It was really fun.
My guest has been Ina Garten, founder of the Barefoot Contessa. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anyone with an email address can send money using their credit card or their bank account. In 2002, eBay bought PayPal for $1.5 billion. Welcome. Typically, it's striking to me how when entrepreneurs start out launching a company, the company they set out to launch looks a lot different from the company it becomes ultimately. And I was wondering if you are a victim to that type of evolution.
Well, we started the company in late 98, and we launched the initial PayPal product in the fall of 1999. And I would certainly say that the very first year that we went through a number of different cycles in terms of trying to figure out what we were going to do. We started with security technology on mobile devices, a wallet, sort of a mobile cell phone payment system. And then in the summer and early fall of 1999, we stumbled on this idea of linking money with email. And I think you're right. This is not an unusual kind of a way for things to develop, especially at the very early stages of the company.
My understanding was that you went out to venture capitalists initially to try to raise money for this encryption software called FieldLink. And you weren't being very successful in raising that money, so then you then decided, okay, well, let's start a company called Confinity, which does provide payment options using the internet.
Yes. Yeah, we went through several different names early on. There was a FieldLink, then there was Confinity, and then we hit on we actually hired a naming company, and they came up with 1,000 different names, and we liked PayPal the best. But yes, so we did iterate through a whole bunch of these things. I probably spoke with had maybe 100 separate meetings with venture capitalists or more in the course of 1999.
How did you meet your partner, Max Levchin? He's from the Ukraine, mm-hmm. and he was a programmer since he was about 10 years old. How did you and he come into contact initially?
I was giving a talk at Stanford in the summer of 98, and we talked afterwards and became friends, and basically he was trying to figure out how to start another company. He had already started a few of them back in college at University of Illinois. I was actually in the process of I was running a very small fund at the time and helping invest in various companies and things like that. We basically started working together. I was going to help him find a CEO, so I helped him interview various people. And then at the end of the process, he asked me to be the CEO. And I said, well, you know, I'll do this for a few months till we get somebody else. And it then evolved into a four-year commitment. It was quite an extraordinary time.
What was your lecture, by the way, about at Stanford?
It was related to international finance or something like that, which is my background had been in finance.
You spent quite a lot of time at Stanford. You went to undergrad at Stanford, and then you went to Stanford Law School. And while you were at Stanford College, you started the Stanford Review, which is a libertarian conservative paper.
I had gone to Stanford for 7 years in a row, and so there was a whole set of people from that area that I was, you know, pretty familiar with, and I had worked together. And it was actually one of the great things when we started PayPal was there were a lot of people we were able to hire from out of that network.
You're talking about the importance of community, which you really found in Silicon Valley and in Stanford. But it's ironic to me because it seems like both you and Max, to some degree, had quite a nomadic upbringing. Can you tell me a little bit about where you're from and how you got to California ultimately?
I was born in Germany. My parents emigrated to the U.S. when I was about a year old. We lived in Africa for a few years. And so I ended up going to about 7 different elementary schools, which is kind of a lot. But from about junior high school on, we were living in Northern California. Max was born in the Ukraine, as you said, and his parents emigrated to the U.S. when he was 16 years old. And as Max liked to put it, they left in August of 91, which is in the weeks when the Soviet Union disappeared and was replaced by Russia. And so he was a citizen of no country.
What was the impetus for your family to move to the U.S.?
My dad was just doing some master's college work in the U.S., and so he was an engineer.
And what was your mom doing?
My mom had been working for an airline, but then basically became a homemaker when my brother and I were born. And, you know, our family was sort of extremely – all sorts of things about everyone's family that are kind of eccentric and strange and interesting. But I think we were very, very focused on education. I remember one anecdote when I was growing up in fifth grade. My mother concluded that we weren't doing enough work in school, and the teacher wasn't pushing us hard enough. So one day, you know, she showed up in my class and just sat in on the class all day to see what was going on. And the various kids were saying, "Oh, your mom's here." And, you know, anyway, so, but it was, you know, I think it was a good thing on the whole.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. And my guest today is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anybody with an email address can send or receive money using credit card or their bank account. There's a quote about you. Actually, you said, every month you think you're going to die, and every other month you think you're going to take over the world. And this is an emblematic of your sort of roller coaster ride with PayPal.
I don't know if that's something you have at every single company. I think a lot of them do feel like that on the inside, where it is a bit of this extraordinary roller coaster. And I think PayPal was an extreme version of this, and it grew at a rate of about 5 to 7% a day, compounding daily. So compound math is very powerful. So, you know, by mid-November, we were up to about 1,000 people. By the end of 99, we were up to 12,000. By February 2nd of 2000, we were up to 100,000. By mid-April, we were up to 1 million.
How did you achieve that growth?
Well, we had some initial bonuses that we gave people to sign up. And then in January of 2000, we noticed that a lot of people were starting to use it on eBay. And so we developed a lot of features that were especially targeted for the eBay auction market, and you know, where you had both people who were both buyers and sellers, which meant that you'd send money to someone and they would turn around and they'd buy something from somebody else, And so it was naturally sort of this incredibly viral place where you got phenomenal growth rates. So that was sort of the good thing. The growth was just, you know, off the charts. And then, of course, there were competitive issues in that large parts of the payment industry, are fairly, nothing ever changes. You have sort of Visa, MasterCard, the Visa, MasterCard duopoly saw as a threat. There were government regulatory questions about what the regulatory regime for this was. So it was a completely new payment system. So was it a bank? Was it a money transmitter? You know, what were we? And what regulatory box did we fall in? You know, our initial position was, well, we shouldn't be regulated at all because we don't fit into any of the boxes. And then eventually we pushed for being regulated as a money transmitter, similar to Western Union, which I think is probably the correct box. And of course, that's much less regulated than, say, a bank.
So let's dissect that a little more, this Western Union notion. Ironically, I feel like you are innovative in that you are actually using cash to move around from buyer to seller, whereas other companies who were innovating were using, you know, cyber cash or digicash or replacements for dollars.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you thought initially of using those cash replacements, or from the inception you said, okay, no, we're going to be a little more old school and use actual cash.
One of the things that was a benefit when we got the company started in 99 was that there had been a whole slew of internet payment companies that had been started in the very first wave of internet companies back in 94, 95 that basically thought you were going to create this new electronic currency on the internet. And by 99, they had were all sort of floundering for one reason or another. The biggest one was people were just not using them. And so the question was, why give someone cyber cash? You know, we could give you a chicken, or we could give you, Malaysian ringgit, or we could give you a U.S. dollar. And in fact, currency is a massive network phenomenon. And, you know, the reason, you know, a $100 bill is something that you would like to have is because there are other people who would like to have that $100 bill. And so we're much better off giving you something which leverages off this already pre-existing currency network than trying to start a completely new one from scratch.
What did you do to incentivize people to adopt the service initially?
Well, we initially incentivized people by giving them referral bonuses.
Of how much?
It was about $10 if you signed up and $10 if you referred somebody else who signed up. So it was $20 per customer acquisition cost.
And were these all your friends initially?
It was initially the people at the company, and then they got other people to sign up and just rolled out in concentric circles like that. And you know, we initially were thinking, you know, this is crazy spending, giving people $20 to get them to sign up. But I realized that it was cheaper than all the alternatives.
How did you even have the cash initially to give $5, $10 per person? Where did you get that capital initially?
Well, we went through a whole series of venture capital financing rounds. Nokia was one of our early investors. We originally started with this sort of wireless small device focus.
How much did they invest?
They invested initially about $3 million. Then we had another financing round late 99. But then in early 2000, March 2000, as the service was taking off, we raised about $100 million, which turned out to be quite fortuitous timing. People, you know, they were lining up to write us checks because it was, you know, at the very peak of the boom.
But then that turned very quickly.
Yes.
So you were very lucky to get in and raise that money.
We closed the $100 million round on Friday, March 31st. And I remember it was the next Monday the market basically collapsed.
I want to go back to the competitive situation. There were a lot of companies that came and went before you came on board, but there was one competitor that stuck and that might have been a formidable foe for you guys, and that was X.com. What were they doing that made you pay attention to them?
There were a number of people who launched these services around the same time. And basically, Confinity, which had the PayPal service, and X.com were the two that had launched them at more or less identical times and were both growing very, very quickly. It was, you know, this ferocious competition. They were four blocks down the street from us in downtown Palo Alto.
Did you know them personally?
We didn't know them personally, but, you know, you sort of had, you know, you had a meeting every day where you were exhorting the engineers to, you know, work harder. And it's a somewhat disturbing account of human nature. I'd never seen people work as hard as, you know, when it was like, you know, the enemy is four blocks away. You know, both companies were spending money at an exponentially growing rate. You know, our customer base was growing exponentially. We also had exponentially growing burn rates. And it turned out we were both kind of freaked out about it. And so we finally decided in early March to do this 50-50 combination between the two companies, which had all sorts of challenges. So, you know, each company had about 60 people. You combined them into one company with 120. So it was like you hired all of a sudden 60 people that you hadn't interviewed. But it was worth it, if for no other reason than that gave the company the necessary momentum to raise that $100 million in March of 2000 that then carried the combined company to profitability.
Whose decision was it to merge with X.com, or at least to start a conversation with X.com? Did you say one day, okay, I'm going to go down four blocks and knock on their door?
It was December 31st, 99. I was on the internet. I decided, well, I have to actually get an account on X.com to see what our competitor is doing. So I signed up the account, and 10 minutes later, the CEO from X.com called me up and said, welcome to our service, and then suggested that we should maybe talk, and we ended up getting together and over the next few months figuring out a way to get the companies to work together.
I want to talk some more about the competitive situation, about the credit card companies and the banks. Why did they look you over initially?
I would say there were two things. One was that the whole thing happened incredibly quickly. So, you know, you have to realize nobody was expecting a new payment service to arise in, you know, a matter of months. And then I think the second part of it was that, you know, at the end of the day, we did not actually take away business from Visa or MasterCard. If anything, we expanded their business because we enabled people to use their credit cards in contexts where they'd never used credit cards before. And so, yes, some of the larger payment companies would have preferred to capture this market for themselves entirely. But at the same time, it was not as though there were people working at these companies whose jobs were being threatened if we were going to be successful, because this was just not a market they were in at all. It was a completely new market.
When you first met Max and you understood that he had a good computer programming acumen, how are you convinced that his technology and the technology that you were building was ironclad and was more secure than everybody else's? I mean, because that is really the heart of your business, is
yes,
to be able to transact in a very secure, protective way.
Well, there were several technology challenges. I mean, one was obviously to make the thing scalable so that you could serve millions of people and it wouldn't break. And Max had actually built some scalable systems before, so we're pretty confident on that score. The security piece was a bit trickier in that, you know, we didn't quite appreciate all the security challenges that we would have. In some ways, had we appreciated them, we might never have launched the company. And it's not like it's a single tech problem to solve. It's more like this iterative process of dealing with all kinds of different, very creative people in, you know, Russia and various other places trying to figure out new and improved ways to steal your money. You know, there were conventional ways you could have solved it by requiring, you know, enormous amounts of information about each customer before they used the service. But that would have just basically made the service unusable. So you have to sort of look at the fraud problem in the context of some of the other challenges, such as the convenience challenge. And so the real issue was this trade-off between how much fraud would we tolerate versus how inconvenient did we want to make it for customers.
That's right.
If there was no trade-off, you could have stopped the fraud pretty easily, but you would have pretty much shut down the service too. And this was actually one of the challenges a lot of the large banks had. They were very focused on the fraud problem, but they ended up creating services that were basically unusable. And I think that ended up being one of the most valuable technologies that actually was developed. It was certainly not what we thought was going to be the core technology, but it turned out to be a core competitive asset just because people were not willing to enter the business because they didn't understand the fraud problem.
We did talk before about eBay becoming a surprisingly good complement to PayPal. And after you went public in 2002, eBay bought you shortly thereafter. How long were you public before eBay bought you?
Well, we took the company public in February of 2002, and then eBay announced the acquisition in July, 5 months later, and then it was completed in October, towards the end of 2002. So we had had conversations with eBay for a number of years before then. The clearly were enormous synergies. It was very difficult to know what the right value of it was. Once the company had been taken public, there was sort of a market valuation on it, and then it was much more straightforward at that point to negotiate a deal with eBay.
How much money did you raise in the public offering?
We raised about $70 million. We had raised about $220 million in private capital beforehand.
I've heard before that you think that PayPal is linked to sort of international peace or prosperity. And I was wondering if you can narrow that down a little bit more. What do you mean by that?
That's so megalomaniacal. You know, I think that if we can have a system in the world based on trade instead of people fighting each other, that would be sort of make for a much, much better world. And that's, you know, I'm very much in favor of free trade, free movement of capital, trying to help people forge commercial relationships across all sorts of geographic and cultural barriers. And I thought that sort of the critical part of the infrastructure for that is a seamlessly functioning global payment system. The T-shirt slogan was PayPal was the new world currency. And I think that turned out, you know, we didn't quite live up to that, but I think to the extent we've pushed the envelope a little bit more in that direction, I think it has made the world a better place. I really do.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me, Jesse.
My guest has been Peter Thiel, the former CEO and co-founder of PayPal. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.